Like to call to order the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance today, Tuesday, January 11, 2011, our first meeting here this morning, and I'd ask the clerk to take the roll.
Smith?
Here.
Shemansky?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Champion?
Here.
Grunheimer?
Here.
Lee? Lesh? Liebling?
Here.
Meserol?
Here.
Schumacher?
Here.
Slocum? Tilbury? Vogel?
Here.
Wardlow?
Here.
Thank you.
I'd like to note and let the record reflect that we have a substitution or replacement. Representative Hillstrom is here instead of Representative Slocum. That appointment was approved, requested, and approved by the Speaker yesterday, I believe.
That's correct.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
I'm going to take the Chair's prerogative to offer a few comments before we start. Then we're going to go to each committee member and each staff member here on the committee and take a couple of minutes to tell about yourself, staff. I'd like to hear your area of expertise and work for the committee. I'm going to just take a minute, and hopefully you won't forget my comments too soon, because I may remind you of them. I want to call the meeting to order and offer a few comments. First of all, this is a day of honor for me individually and for us as a committee. It was with a great deal of pleasure and respect I saw the roster of representatives who were selected to serve on this committee. You bring a range of life experiences and perspective to the most important work that's going to be done by this legislature over the next 5 months. Your opinions, your guidance of the chair and of this committee is important to me, and I'll be looking for that. Our committee is assigned to live up to the two most important promises that America and Minnesota make to our citizens, to our people in this state, and those are the right of notice of what the law demands of them and the guarantee of an opportunity to be heard. If Americans and Minnesotans do not have those rights, then they are not free people. Without notice and opportunity to be heard, we are nothing more than subjects of a regime that neither speaks wisely nor listens closely. Our job as a committee and as legislators is to make sure that the doors to the courthouses remain open, and to see to it that the destitute or anyone who has to go to court does not stand alone when they face the loss of their freedom or their property. We will be crafting the budget for the judicial branch, the Office of the Public Defender, for legal services, for example, and we will also be reviewing proposals for new technologies that may be proposed for use in the courts. In those hearings, we will not just be asking whether the new technologies can work. We will be asking how these procedures may affect the rights of both the individual person and the society as a whole. At some point, this committee may be asked to review bonding requests related to court buildings, court assets that may wait until next year. Because of the broad jurisdiction of this committee, we also may be reviewing legislation that first comes to light in some other committees. I will work with all of you, Republican or Democrat, I will work with all of you to make sure that any requests are given careful consideration by this chairman and by this committee. I've talked now about due process, about notice, about the opportunity to be heard. Now it's time for this committee to live up to those promises that we make to our fellow Americans. In your folder, you'll find a draft of rules for this committee. Take a look at those. We can discuss them at our next hearing if you choose. I will be working closely with Vice Chairman Ron Shemansky, DFL Lead Sheldon Johnson, and I hope each of you will feel free to contact me at any time and help in the guidance of this committee. We're going to go around to members, starting, I think, no offense, but to my extreme right down on the end of actually, I'll start with our vice chair, but first we're going to go to staff, because without staff, we really couldn't function. So I just would look to my right and ask you first to introduce yourself and what your area of expertise would be first.
My name is Jody Withers. I'll be the committee administrator for this committee.
My name is Becky Perius. I'm a analyst and attorney with the House Research Department. It's a nonpartisan department, and I've spent the past 6 years working on the areas of crime and courts.
My name is Emily Adrians, and I am the fiscal analyst for the committee. I am not an attorney, but I'm married to one, so I feel like by proxy I get.
Nobody's perfect.
I'm Dennis Verdon. I'm Republican Research.
Right here.
Joyce Fox,
committee legislative assistant.
Vice Chair Shemansky, go ahead, and then we'll just pick it up.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to use my full two-minute allotment?
Yes, sir.
I'm Ron Shemansky, State Representative, District 18A, encompassing McLeod and Carver County. I'm in my third term in the Minnesota Legislature, and I'm proud to serve on the Judiciary Committee. It's my first exposure. Last year, I served on the Public Safety Policy Committee with Chair Hillstrom, and so I have a preliminary exposure, but I'm looking forward to working with the Judiciary, Finance, and Policy Committee this year. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sheldon Johnson. I represent Southeast St. Paul. I'm in my sixth term. I spent the last 35 years working in corrections, in the family court, in the juvenile and adult court. I think the first committee I sat in when I was elected was a committee very similar to this, where Chair Smith, you were running the show, so I know you're a very capable chair, and I look forward to working with you on these issues.
Good morning. I'm Tina Liebling. I represent District 30A, which is part of Rochester, and I am an attorney. I have spent part of my professional career as a public defender and part of it in private criminal defense practice. And I served on the Public Safety Finance Committee for the last two terms. I'm now in my fourth term.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
I'm Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park, District 46B. I have served on public safety area my entire time in the legislature. It's just been named lots of different things each term. This is my 11th year. I'm the former Public Safety Policy Chair, and I'm excited to be on the committee, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Champion.
Thank you so much. I am Bobby Champion. I represent Senate District 58B, which is the southern part of North Minneapolis, the North Loop, and half of downtown Minneapolis. I am an attorney. I've been practicing for over 15 years. I've worked for the Legal Rights Center, also with the Attorney General's Office as an Assistant Attorney General under both Skip Humphrey and Mike Hatch. I've done entertainment law with Terry Lewis and Jimmy Jam, which are world-renowned producers. And so I continue to practice law right now in the areas of family law, criminal defense, both on the state and federal level, as well as entertainment and some other things, and a lot of business law.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Doug Wardlow, and I represent District 38B, Egan, roughly the eastern half of Egan, a little bit of the southern central portion of Egan. I'm an attorney as well. This is my first term, and it's an honor and a privilege to serve on this committee, Mr. Chair. I actually served as a clerk on the Minnesota Supreme Court for 1 year right after I graduated from law school, so I got to see a little bit of the judiciary from the inside, so hopefully that'll bring some perspective here. But again, I'm privileged to be here.
Very good. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bruce Vogel. I'm from District 13B, that is right in central Minnesota, Kandiyohi County. I live in Wilmer. I've been married for 28 years. I have four children, six grandchildren, and you know, really, my background, I'm a realtor by profession right now, but I've also worked in the construction field as well, and so this is my first adventure into this. I know some attorneys and some judges, but but I've never practiced law, but this is an exciting appointment for me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Joe Schumacher. I am from Laverne. This is my first term. I'm from District 22A, and that's the district that borders South Dakota and Iowa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat Mazerol, District 41B, West Bloomington and South Edina. I am a licensed attorney. I practiced for 13 years, part of that time in insurance defense litigation and part as a general practice. And then I've spent 20 years in the personal trust area in which we work with estate planning and probate.
Very good. Representative Kreisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Kreisel. I represent District 57A, which is Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, South St. Paul, and Great Cloud Island. My background's primarily military, but I have a lot of friends in the law enforcement community that I served with, and it's an interest of mine, so I'm happy to be a part of the committee. Thanks.
Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, Glenn Grunhagen, I represent District 25A. That's Eastern Sibley and Le Sueur County, southwest and south of Minneapolis-St. Paul here. A couple things about me. I own an independent insurance agency that I started from scratch about 30 years ago. Also, I've served on our public school board for the last 16 years as a member. The other thing about, I'm not a lawyer either, and but I did do jail ministry for 13 years, okay? Wasn't in jail, did jail ministry, okay? I got to leave after I was there. But so I do have an interest in the judicial system and its effect on Minnesota citizens, especially the victims.
Very good. Representative.
Good morning. I'm losing my voice. Good morning. I'm Diane Anderson. I represent House District 38A, which is the other half of the western half of Eagan and three precincts in Burnsville. I am a small business owner, but I've also done some citizen advocacy work here at the Capitol. I was a two-year member of a Supreme Court task force and have met and worked with many of the Supreme Court and the judges here, and looking forward to being on this committee and want to just make sure we have a great judicial system.
Representative Cornish.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Tony Cornish, and I represent Blue Earth, Faribault, and Waseca counties, or parts thereof. I have been in law enforcement for 36 years. Started off as a policeman, then a deputy sheriff, and then a jailer, and a game warden, and retired, and then they drug me back in. And now I'm the chief of police of Lake Crystal, and although not an attorney, I try to give prosecutors and judges as much work as they can handle.
And my name is Steve Smith. I'm in my 11th term as a state representative. I live in the city of Mound, which is the west southwest corner of the Hennepin County, stretching from St. Bonnie all the way to south end of Plymouth, around west and north ends of Lake Minnetonka. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law since 1976, two different states, Oklahoma and Minnesota, and I'll just get a plug-in for the United States Air Force. I got a 22-year-old boy, just turned 22, and he spent 4 years in the United States Air Force Military Police, two tours of Iraq, and he's at home living with Dad. Thank God. Representative Lane, go ahead.
I'm Carolyn Lane, representative in Columbia Heights, Fridley, and St. Anthony.
Very good. We're going to get right to work, committee. I'd like to introduce first the Chief Justice. And like I told you earlier, I told you the truth. I'm chairing this committee. I'm not necessarily running it. So however you choose to proceed, please do.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Gilday, and I'm the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court and the chair of the Coalition to Preserve Minnesota's Justice System. We are very grateful for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. The court is in session today, and so with the chair's permission, I will make some remarks, and but I hope that you all will be all right with the lawyers among you. I know will be all right with my leaving. It's never good to be late for court. So I'll be leaving at some point, and my apologies for that. I'm going to start out by saying a few words about the coalition and then talk about the roles and challenges of the judiciary, and then ask my colleagues, two of whom are with me now and many of whom are sitting behind me, to speak about their organizations and their challenges. Our objective today is to paint for you a big picture of Minnesota's justice system. We come before you today not on behalf of judges or lawyers or probation officers or law enforcement. We come today on behalf of the abused little girl who needs protection, the small business owner who's trying to enforce a contract, the tenant who is seeking return of her security deposit, and the state who is seeking to hold an offender accountable in pursuit of the safety and security of all of our communities. The justice system exists not for those of us at this table or those like us who work in the system every day. The justice system exists for all 5 million Minnesotans, the citizens we serve. All 5 million Minnesotans are our constituents. The coalition reflects the fact that the justice system is a highly interdependent ecosystem. As depicted in the first page of the handout that we provided, the component parts of our justice system are inextricably connected. What happens to one part of the system affects every other part. And in recent years, increasing budget constraints have highlighted that reality. The coalition was formed in the fall of 2009 in an effort to prevent further deterioration of our justice system. You have a list of current coalition members on page 2 of our handout. And as you can see, it includes law enforcement, prosecutors, defense, victims advocacy, state and local bar associations, labor, and other civic groups. The coalition is here today to give voice to our Minnesota justice system. And that system is at a breaking point. Ensuring access to justice is a core function of government that our citizens expect and that they deserve. Yet many parts of Minnesota's justice system are faced with significant service reductions due to insufficient funding for staff and operations. Justice system spending has been reduced to a level which jeopardizes the right of Minnesotans to receive timely resolution of civil and criminal matters, a right promised to all of our citizens and embodied in our Constitution. And that's what we're here to talk about this morning. Now, let me start with a description of the judicial branch, the challenges we are facing, the efficiency measures we are undertaking to adjust to the budget realities that some have termed the, quote, new normal. And I also want to touch on the impact of further budget reductions. Each of my justice system partners will do likewise for their respective organizations. The mission of the judicial branch is to provide equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. The branch is comprised of 315 judges and 2,500 employees. Our annual budget is approximately $285 million, less than 2% of the state's general fund. We operate in each of our 87 counties and handle about 1.7 million cases a year, from abuse and neglect of children and vulnerable adults to commercial and business disputes to traffic tickets and all the way up to first-degree murder cases. We do not control our workload. We must take each and every case that is filed. And we are mandated by our Constitution to handle every case promptly and without delay. As page 3 of our handout indicates, everything comes through our doors. Our court system is the backbone of our democracy. It protects the most vulnerable among us. It ensures the rule of law that is essential to a civil, organized society. It provides stability and accountability that is required for commercial activity to thrive. And it is the gateway to justice for all that is promised in our Constitution. Over the past 3 years, the judiciary has experienced base budget reductions totaling almost $19 million. This has left us operating nearly 10% short-staffed and 20 judges short of need. These budget challenges have caused unacceptable delays in our ability to dispense timely justice. I'm going to give you just a sampling of the impacts that are being felt now. One out of four serious felonies takes more than a year to resolve in our state. In Olmsted County, felony trials are being scheduled for April 2012. In Douglas County, it now takes twice as long to get a misdemeanor trial as it did just a few years ago. And for 30% of abused children that are taken out of their home, it takes longer than a year for that child to learn where their permanent home is going to be. These delays are not acceptable. They are not what our citizens deserve. The courts have a vital government function to perform. And we are also keenly aware of our obligation to maximize the use of the scarce taxpayer dollars that we are given. And so the judicial branch has been aggressive in searching for ways to contain costs. We instituted a hiring freeze, a pay freeze, a voluntary separation program, leave without pay, layoffs, and voluntary furloughs. We have cut positions throughout the system and flattened our management structure so that everyone is doing more. And we are redoubling our efforts to find more efficiencies, to redesign how we do what we do, and to expand the use of technology to reduce costs while doing all that we can to continue to provide Minnesotans with quality justice. I will save a lot of the details for our budget presentation later in this session, but I do want to give you just a little teaser, if you will, about some of the initiatives that are underway. First, we are moving the processing of the 1 million payable citations that courts handle each year from 87 counties into one centralized virtual payment center, which has staff around the state working from home offices to process paper and electronic citations and staff a statewide call center. We are working with the law enforcement community to allow traffic citations to be entered into squad car computers, transferred electronically to police and sheriff department's case systems, and then sent directly over the computer to the court's case management system, saving time for law enforcement and court staff. We are partnering with the BCA to implement e-charging. This system will enable county attorneys to file criminal complaints electronically. We've expanded the use of interactive television video conferencing for use in certain criminal proceedings to reduce travel time and cost for our justice system partners. And we are implementing e-filing for civil cases, starting with a pilot in Hennepin County. The judicial branch has undertaken extraordinary efforts to find and implement efficiencies to keep functioning despite budget cuts and shortfalls. We recognize, however, that in matters of justice, with the constitutional mandates of due process, notice, and the opportunity to be heard, there are clear limitations on our ability to manage our way out of further cuts. as page 4 of our handout reflects, the budget cuts and shortfalls that we have sustained in recent years are already taking a tremendous toll on our justice system. Thank you so much for your attention, for all that you have done, and for all that you will do. And I now would like to call on my friend and colleague, John Stewart, our state public defender.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I'm proud to live in a country and live in a state that has very high expectations of the justice system. We expect the justice system to protect public safety, and we also expect the justice system to protect individuals' constitutional rights. To make these expectations a reality is a lot of work, and as the Chief Justice has mentioned already, it's work that's done by people in a variety of organizations that are interconnected. That's what I want to focus on here in a minute. But I'd like to first give you a short introduction to public defense. First of all, we work in every courthouse, all 87 counties in Minnesota. We have 675 employees, a mixture of full and part-time. We have part-time defenders in some of the towns where there aren't enough cases to justify having an office. And then we have about 28 offices around the state where there are enough cases to justify having an office. All of our cases are cases where a person is at risk of losing their liberty. That's how they get the constitutional right to have a lawyer. In other words, we don't have the speeding ticket because that's not a loss of liberty case, but we would have a case where somebody might be accused of DUI or domestic violence, or those are the main types of misdemeanors that we do. We also defend people in cases where they're accused of felonies, gross misdemeanors, juvenile delinquency. We cannot refuse cases. We're just like the courts in that regard. We have to take everything that comes in the door. And we function in doing this work by the same ethical standards as any other lawyers in the state. So the result is that public defenders are highly motivated to be efficient. 97% of our budget goes into direct services to clients. 97%. We do our own training in-house using our own people rather than paying to import trainers or paying to send people out of state for training. We created our own case information system that piggybacks on the information that the court collects anyway. So if I'm sitting down interviewing a client, I don't have to ask him his address and birthday and write it down and take it back into my office and type it. I can get that from the court's information system and save that lawyer time and then staff time back at the office. We handle conflicts cases with our own part-time employees. We have projects going working with prosecutors to get the copies of their documents electronically. But I have to say, much of the work that we do simply can't be eliminated. You have to meet the client, you have to get reports, read the reports, talk to the prosecutor, you have to go to court, and all of those functions are kind of irreducible. There's no way to get out of doing those pieces of the work. Since 2008, public defense in Minnesota, we have lost 15% of our attorney staff due to cuts. These losses create problems for our clients, for our staff, and for everybody else that works in the justice system, in addition to creating problems for victims, problems for witnesses, problems for businesses. That's my topic for today. I will say we had a program audit done about a year ago. There's a report online from the legislative auditor from last February, and here's their number one conclusion. It's in the blue pages in the summary in the front. They say public defender cases are too high, resulting in public defenders spending limited time with clients, difficulties preparing cases, and scheduling problems that hinder the efficient operation of the criminal courts. And I'd like to give you a couple of examples of how our shortage hinders the operation of the courts. This is the interconnected or ecosystem part that the Chief Justice was talking about. I was at the meeting of the State Bar Association Assembly on December 10th. This is like the legislature of the State Bar Association. And a judge got up and told this story. Here's this judge, has an afternoon calendar with 17 cases that are set for pretrial conferences, and has got one public defender. But she also is responsible for the sentencing calendar in another courtroom. So all afternoon, she's running back and forth between two courtrooms. And at any given moment, the judge and the judge's staff and the prosecutor and everybody that works in the court, in one of those two courtrooms, they're waiting for the public defender to come back. Now, among the defendants who were waiting all afternoon, at one point a hot argument broke out and the sheriff had to be called. So the sheriff is brought into this. And eventually one of them got fed up and left. So the case was bench warranted. It was referred to the sheriff to go out and pick him up, and the person then would be booked in jail. So while that public defender's running back and forth, you can see that it implicates the judge, the prosecutors, the sheriff's office. Second story. This is a story that a court administrator told the legislative auditor that's reprinted in this report. I'm just going to read you this short story. Court administrator says, "We have a two-hour omnibus hearing this Monday. A public defender's request to continue came in at 3:45 today, Friday. There are 16 officers subpoenaed to testify. The defendant is in custody. The public defender has not been able to get prepared." So besides the public defender client, a judge and prosecutor and their staff, court administration, and 16 law enforcement officers are all affected by that public defender not having been able to get prepared. Plus, of course, additional jail costs to the county for keeping the client in custody. Now, someone might say, well, okay then, deny the request for continuance. But first of all, most people who work in the courts know that this kind of request is legitimate. Maybe these people saw the public defender the day before running back and forth covering two courtrooms. They know that she's telling the truth when she says she hasn't had time to prepare. Secondly, the defendant is entitled by the Constitution to effective assistance of counsel. So if the lawyer is trying to face 16 police witnesses without preparing, there's going to be an appeal, there's going to be an issue of effective assistance of counsel, there's certainly the possibility of the appeals courts ordering a do-over, and then the whole thing has to start again. So, likely, this continuance is going to be granted, which brings me to my last point, which is about delay. That's where all these cases are going. You've heard about Rochester. We know that trials and pretrial conferences are being set now in 2012 because all the available time slots for this year are already used up, and it's, what, January 11th. in 2009 in Minnesota, the Court of Appeals dismissed two violent felony cases for lack of a speedy trial. Cases are reported as State v. Griffin and State v. Faulkner. One of them was an assault on a police officer. Another one is a case where a guy fired a shotgun at a truckload full of kids. The case with the police officer was dismissed because over a period of 8 months, the trial was continued 30 times. Now, in California, and I think of California as the place where if you have a problem, you look out to California and you'll see what the problem would look like if it was bigger. In California, 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court dismissed 18 criminal cases because of lack of a speedy trial. So we're not there yet, but certainly we are headed in that direction. In closing, I'd like to just give you one more short quote. Here's a quote from a public official. It says, cutting public defender staff would result in a dramatic reduction in the services provided to indigent defendants. Those layoffs could result in demands for speedy trials not being met and the inappropriate release of accused criminals. That's from a letter we got from Governor Pawlenty in 2004 telling us not to lay off public defenders. Unfortunately, in 2008, we had to do it in spite of his concern, and that's where we are today. We ourselves are down 15% of our lawyers, but we're also creating a ripple effect through the whole justice system, not because we want to, but because they need us there and we're not there. So thank you for giving us this time to speak this morning.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, affectionately known as SMRLS by anybody who has to say that more than three times. I'm here representing the Civil Legal Services programs. We serve residents of all 87 counties in Minnesota. We provide free legal services to low-income and senior citizen clients. The work we do on behalf of the justice system helps make the courts more efficient. The work we do reduces the number of pro se or unrepresented clients in the system. And if you've ever been in court or observed court, it's a very complicated process to go through without some kind of legal guidance. We help expedite those cases through the system. In addition, we consult with a large number of clients, and many of them we advise they do not have a meritorious case to go forward. Those cases we keep from going to the court system. We also provide a great deal of community legal education, both in out of the office community events where we educate, for example, landlords or tenants about landlord-tenant law in order to prevent legal problems from arising. And we also have community legal education materials that we distribute both in hard copy and online to allow people to be informed about their legal rights and also, in many cases, to solve their own problem without intervention of the court system. Those online and other phone resources we have are available in all 87 counties in Minnesota. In addition, we also leverage a lot of other funds to supplement the state appropriation that we receive. We receive federal funding, we receive funds from attorney registration fees in Minnesota, we receive money from the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account or IOLTA programs where attorneys have money held in trust accounts, small amounts that aren't enough to justify having a separate account for that client's money. Those pooled accounts then, the interest that's earned is paid into the state and distributed to be used for civil legal services. Unfortunately, right now, those interest rates are very low. And so the funding from that program is going to drop substantially in this next biennium compared to the amounts that were available in this current biennium. And lastly, Civil Legal Services has been very successful in raising private funding, both from foundations and from private donations. And so the exactly $11,815,000 appropriation on an annual basis for Civil Legal Services gets leveraged into about $33 million worth of legal services throughout the state. In addition, Legal Services has the lowest pay scales in the justice system. And so by our staff working for lower wages, again, we're able to provide more services for those funds than we would be able to with higher pay scales. Unfortunately, even with that, with the reductions we've had in a variety of funding sources over the last 3 years, we have lost approximately 17% of our attorney staff. And that affects our ability to serve your constituents. Because we have only been able to serve a percentage of the need at any one time, this makes the services even more scarce. And so we spend a significant amount of our time explaining to people why we are not able to handle their case, even though they might be financially eligible for our services. The work that we do has an impact in your communities. We reduce homelessness, which reduces the need for services and for shelters. We allow persons with disabilities to live in the community at a lower cost than if they were in an institution. And then we also work to reduce domestic violence. The one study that has been done to try to determine the impact of what is effective in reducing domestic violence. One of the two statistically valid factors that impacted reduction in domestic violence was the availability of the legal services program in that community. And so being very brief today, look forward to the opportunity to speak with each of you individually and also to present further testimony at future hearings. And as the chief indicated, we do have another group prepared to speak with you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Jim Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney. I'm going to lead off the next panel of three folks here. And I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which I serve as a member of the Board of Directors. County attorneys in Minnesota are solidly behind the need to have adequate funding in our justice system. As the chief indicated and as the charts that are handed out to you clearly show, we are all interconnected. And the county attorneys in our state, as most of you know, do a lot more than just prosecute crime. We're basically, if you look at the all the different components of our system of justice on the handout with the court building as the oversight overlay to it, there are maybe only one item on that entire list that county attorneys are not directly involved in dealing with each and every day in our state. It's important work that we do, obviously, in terms of protecting children, protecting our communities, ensuring that those who commit crimes are brought to justice and held accountable. And we can't do that work without adequate resources ourselves. The distinction between county attorneys and the folks you heard from earlier, our public defenders and our court system, is that county attorneys are funded locally. We're funded at the county level. But don't for one minute think that there isn't a connection between state funding and the county funding of county attorneys and county government, because as you all know, they are very directly connected. Reductions at the state level can certainly impact county attorneys as well. Our association polled my colleagues across the state to ask them about the impacts of budget reductions. I can tell you from one end of this great state to the other, county attorneys are feeling the pinch of reduction as well. In Dakota County, we have three less attorneys working in my office today than we had 3 years ago. I have also lost two support staff, and I can tell you that our caseloads are not dropping significantly in the areas we work with. In some areas, they've leveled off and had slight reductions, but certainly not to the extent that we can do that same work with that many that fewer people in our office. So we're feeling the pinch across the state of Minnesota as well, and we are here to support our court system, our public defenders, our civil legal aid folks, because as they indicated in their earlier testimony, the work that they do is directly connected with our work in terms of protecting our communities. We can't do our jobs without effective public defenders. Public defenders that are there and available in the courtroom in a timely manner so we can continue to process these cases efficiently and effectively. Quite frankly, with the funding they have, it's difficult to do. And I can tell you, John Stewart is not off base when he gives you those examples of delays in the courtroom. We see them every day in our system. Justice delayed is justice denied in many respects, and it's not a good thing when that occurs. And our civil legal aid folks as well, they do an important job in our society in terms of helping and assisting those who cannot afford legal counsel themselves to get help. Because even the county attorneys in our state, when we're prosecuting cases involving domestic violence, and our city attorney colleagues as well, who I'm in essence speaking on behalf of also, that do wonderful work with the lower level offenses, when we're handling those types of cases, we can't represent the individuals in civil court when they go in to seek protection orders to protect themselves in addition to the prosecution that might occur. That's where the civil legal aid folks come in and do critical, life-saving, in many cases, work in our system of justice. It's extremely important, and adequate funding needs to be made available. I can tell you, as well as the courts are working on innovations, county attorneys are doing that as well across our state in terms of approving our use of technology in processing information. Dakota County, for example, has a very active, a very highly respected a group. It's called the CIGIN, the Criminal Justice Information Integration Network, which we have developed with our law enforcement colleagues in our community, the opportunities to exchange information quicker, more effectively, electronically. And we are doing great things in those areas as we work with the state in terms of improving efficiencies. Those types of improvements, the e-charging, those things are important innovations, and we will continue to work and strive towards doing everything we possibly can with innovation to improve our efficiency. But as has been indicated, there's only so much you can do. We still need the folks to review the cases. We can't have computers take a look at the criminal investigation files that our law enforcement partners bring to us and analyze those facts to determine whether someone should be charged with a crime and what level of crime they should be charged with, or whether there's insufficient evidence to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt. That takes a professional, that takes professional judgment and discretion, and we can't do it without adequate resources to handle those types of cases. There are a couple of, I want to just make sure you're aware of, some unintended consequences of the lack of funding, for example, of our public defenders. When they have to reduce their staffs, when they have to cut back some of the resources and the work that they do, some of those costs get shifted to the counties. For example, the representation of parents in child protection cases, which the public defenders in our state did for many years, has now been shifted because of the lack of resources to their office to counties to pay for that representation. It's another unfunded mandate to county government, and it shouldn't be our responsibility. It should be funded at the state level where it always has been, for many, many years. And that's just one example of an unintended consequence. There are other shifts as well, the shifts for paying for expert witnesses and other discovery-related expenses that rightfully should be paid for through the state level if adequate funding was available, but has now been shifted to county government to address. When those costs get shifted, we have fewer resources to fund the needs in our office, in our community corrections departments across our communities, and in other areas as well. I will just close with just one last comment. I've heard the Chief Justice say this many times, and I didn't hear her say it today, so I will say it to you. You know, justice in our state is not an option. It is an obligation. And it has to be considered as one of the highest priorities in our state government, in all levels of our government, as we go forward. And I'm proud to be a part of that system for the last 24 years, working as the Dakota County Attorney, and I'm proud to be a part of this coalition as well. I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, my name's Clifford Paler. I've been a public defender in Hennepin County since 1986. I'm also currently the treasurer of AFSCME, Council 5, that's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we have about 41,000 employees throughout the 87 counties in Minnesota. I'm also on the general board of the AFL-CIO, and I'm here today, Chairman Smith, members, to tell you that I'm proud to be a member of the Chiefs Coalition. I was on the coalition last year at the request of Chief Magnuson. Chief Gilday asked me to continue. I was proud to do so. I'm proud to sit here with these gentlemen from law enforcement. Now, on a personal note, Jim Backstrom tries most of his cases. He doesn't really assign them out. So when he tells you that he knows what's going on in the system, it's because he's actually in court. He's not sitting in an office somewhere. Man, that's to his credit, and I've always admired him for it. But I don't intend to cover all the ground that's been covered, just to reiterate in probably a little stronger terms. I've been doing this for 26 years. I'm the equivalent of a master sergeant in a war zone for the last 26 years. Those on this panel that have done public defense, and there's at least one here, there's another one here that does prosecution, just got the job. You know that this system isn't just dysfunctional, it is flat out broken. And I can't stress it enough. 26 years ago, the first client I ever had, I got the case dismissed. And it was on a Friday, and he didn't get out of jail till Monday. And I asked what the heck happened, and the judge told me, well, we just don't have enough people. Somebody dropped the ball. That happens actually fairly regularly. You cannot practice law in Hennepin County unless you know enough about the bureaucracy to call over to the jail to make sure your client gets out. Otherwise, they may not. But what I really want to talk about is how, if you analogize this to a sewer system, the sewer pipes are broken, and it is not just wrecking the room that the sewer pipe's broken in, it's wrecking the entire house of the judiciary. The entire judicial branch is affected by this. I see so many times, on a daily basis, victims sitting in hallways waiting for cases to go forward, and they're not going to go forward. I see witnesses that have taken the day off to come down and testify, and they're not going to testify. I had a prosecutor curse me, probably inappropriately, but I understood her anger, because I wouldn't plead a client guilty, because we couldn't get a judge, because there was no courtrooms available. And she cursed me and said, you know this woman isn't coming back here. And I said, I can't help you. I have a duty to represent my client. Your complaint is with some other people, some other place. But the main point, I think, that I wanted to address is that on the coalition, besides myself, is a representative from Sher Knutson, who is the president of the AFL-CIO. We have about 400,000 members statewide. I can tell you that we see this as a bipartisan issue. All across the state, in towns, the towns where you represent folks and the counties that you represent folks in, are working people that want a functioning judicial system. Because at the end of the day, they may not have a job. They may not have any prospects of getting a job in this hard economy, but at least they have a court system that functions. So if they're going through the divorce, the throes of a divorce, a bankruptcy, anything that would bring them to court, at least they know, or at least they knew at one point in time, that they could get a resolution to their problem. I look around the room and I see a lot of folks that I know, and I'm really glad because I see strong folks of goodwill that I think want to tackle this problem. I see a lot of other folks, frankly, that I can't wait to get to know and talk about these issues. But I was active in the campaign this year, and I was blessed with getting to know the governor. And what I can tell you is the governor has asked me on a couple of occasions to make sure that the court's budget and the public defense budget got to him and to the important people here in the Capitol that are going to be dealing with it. You've got an equal partner in the governor in funding the judiciary and funding public defense. We see it as a bipartisan issue. We'd like to work with you. We think that the governor will come to the table. He's been very solicitous. And what I want to tell you is we've pushed this problem now, like the budget. It's been pushed and pushed and pushed till there's no easy solutions left. But it's a constitutional issue. It's not an agency. It's a constitutional issue. And we hope and we know that you will treat it accordingly. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Dave Kolb. I belong to the Minnesota State Chiefs of Police Association. I'm the co-chair of their legislative committee, and I'm currently the chief of police for the city of Minnetrista. I'm here on behalf of the State Chiefs Association, which represents over 350 police chiefs from communities throughout the state. My comments and my examples were compiled from those members, so I apologize that I'm primarily going to be reading them, but they do come from a broad section of our membership representing law enforcement across Minnesota. I'm here to share with you some of the challenges law enforcement is experiencing as part of a judicial system near its breaking point. I would like to share with you three of the most significant unintended negative consequences to the vacant positions in prosecution and defense as well, and that these are causing problems with the ability of Minnesota law enforcement agencies to carry out their mission. First is the delay in prosecution due to the lack of public defender or judge availability. This delay has several consequences for law enforcement, including witnesses who are hesitant to testify due to the length of time between when the incident occurs and the day the case finally makes it to court, the victim's loss of faith in the system, and the resulting lack of confidence in law enforcement's ability to help. One example of that clearly would be the domestic assault situation, which frequently we find victims very hesitant to seek help and to cooperate with a successful prosecution. Having these types of delays just further exacerbates that. Second is the continued viability and effectiveness of law enforcement agencies hamstrung by extensive budget cuts. These cuts have led to reductions in police officers and support staff, and in some cases even resulted in the dissolution of police agencies, leaving the function to the sheriff's office. In actuality, sheriffs are facing the same budgetary issues as police departments, and many lack the capacity or desire to meet these increased demands for service. A compounding factor for our law enforcement agency's budget woes is the overtime the agency is required to pay to our officers to sit at the courthouse. And you've heard some examples today of cases and witnesses and others waiting for cases to go forward. Add the additional costs to summon and compensate witnesses, transport prisoners, and provide courtroom security, and it is clear that there's a ripple effect from an unfunded judge position or public defender, and it quickly becomes more expensive for the community at large. Third on the list of adverse impacts on law enforcement is the creation of payables, which converts minor criminal offenses into what is now effectively a criminal penalty. The effect this has had and will continue to have on public safety is rather subtle in appearance, but dramatic in effect. Treating these minor offenses as more of a civil violation means the loss of a critical tool in the overall enforcement mission of our police agencies. Enforcing these minor offenses allows an agency to implement their community-oriented policing or problem-oriented policing philosophies, strategies that are essential to addressing quality of life issues in neighborhoods, commercial centers, business complexes, and recreational facilities. The creation of payable offenses damages this effectiveness, chiefly through the loss of an officer's ability to ask that next question during a traffic stop or an investigatory stop. An officer who develops reasonable suspicion that a crime may be occurring is no longer able to search or investigate further, as the offense is now only a civil violation. In other words, one of the most effective, time-honored, and basic tools of a police officer is no longer allowed on a stop for a payable offense. As you can see, there are many unintended and systematic consequences when any one element of criminal justice is underfunded. Anything that affects one part of the system reaches out to touch many other parts. This is especially critical when it involves one of the core responsibilities of government. The plan developed by this coalition will address many of these issues created for law enforcement in general and the criminal justice system as a whole by the lack of funding. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. County Attorney Backstrom, I think I would just tell you that I've sat on this committee under different names, policy, finance, for 20 years, so I've had an opportunity to hear you frequently, not only see you on TV, but hear you come and testify. You are energetic, and I've learned to listen to you. Likewise, Mr. Paler, same thing for a number of years. And I'm happy to see the police chief of Minnetrista here. I didn't know you were going to be here. Minnetrista is in my house district. So good to see you, Chief. I assure you, if I drive through Minnetrista on my way home, I will keep it below the speed limit.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Terry Botel. I have the honor this year of serving as the president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. The Minnesota State Bar Association is a group of 17,000 lawyers who are voluntary members of our association. We appear today in support of adequate funding for the judicial and the justice system. We appear with the other members of the coalition. They are consist of the people that are on your list. They are the district bar associations, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, district bar associations throughout the state of Minnesota, all of whom are interested in this topic and discuss it frequently. I had the occasion of being in Dawson, Minnesota, on Friday with the other officers and the executive director of our association, and we had exactly the same discussion there that we are having here today. So it is a statewide issue, the importance of adequate funding of the judiciary cannot be overstated. We're joined by people in the specialty bars. A good example would be the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, Minnesota Association for Justice, the Lavender Bar Association, all those people that have an interest. So we've got a broad-based coalition. We are doing what we can do to support adequate funding for the judiciary. It was said earlier today that the courts, of course, and the justice system doesn't exist for lawyers. It exists for the people on our streets, our neighbors, our families, our friends, those businesses, large and small, in our community that have to access the justice system to redress their rights. Many of those folks may not use the system very often. I think there's some people that get through their life without having to access the justice system from the standpoint of being in court at all. The matters that they bring to the court when they do have to come to the court and come to the justice system are often not extraordinary matters. They're the matters that affect us all, that we all observed in our own experience. The breadth of experience on this committee is very impressive, and I know there's a number of lawyers, but When people need a justice system, they need it to be responsive to their needs. Consider individual citizens who may need to seek redress of problems relative to abuse or neglect. Those family law cases that deal with very important custody issues, maintenance and support issues. Individuals that seek relief from the courts for harassment or stalking, how very important they are, and how delay in addressing their needs can have very significant adverse consequences to them. Those people seek the benefits of the various specialty courts that you may be aware of. I know you are aware of them. Housing courts, juvenile courts, probate courts, drug courts, family law courts. And those are all the things that they come for their ordinary day-to-day problems and business to the justice system in the state of Minnesota. We hear a lot about creating an environment in the state of Minnesota that is friendly for the creation and growth and sustenance of businesses. They have the same needs. Often their problems are not extraordinary problems. We all hear about major business cases that find their way into the justice system, but quite often they're the rather simple matters of a business enforcing a contract or trying to collect a payable that threatens the existence of their business. And if they can't collect that payable or enforce that contract, it threatens not only the existence of the business, but the jobs that they create in our community. So very, very important for both individuals and business to have a properly funded court system. I feel a little bit like I'm telling you something you already know, and maybe making the point the hard way, but the people that seek redress in the courts seek it for relatively straightforward, common matters. They're often in a time of distress or crisis, and when they need the courts, they really need them, and they really need the courts to be responsive. You can imagine in the list of items that I, simple items that I talked about, that if there was a significant delay in responding by the justice system in responding to their needs, the consequences that it may have. It makes all the difference to have an efficient and responsive justice system. You're all aware of the unacceptable consequences. We operate by a rule of law. You know that, I'm sure. And that allows our society to be stable and orderly. It allows us to deliver on the constitutional guarantee of access to justice for all citizens. And it enforces our public safety in an environment that we can effectively operate in and deals effectively with lawlessness. You might ask what the lawyers are doing. Gary Hurd from Civil Legal Services in an earlier presentation talked about the ways that lawyers, a good lawyer, of course, the first thing they do is they see how the issue can be most efficiently resolved. If it can be resolved without accessing the justice system in a formal manner, they will attempt to do that. If litigation ensues, lawyers engage in the alternative dispute process, as you know, mediations, arbitrations, many matters get removed, never even find their way into court or get removed from court through those processes. Some cases have to be tried. It's a small percentage in the civil area where I work, and it's probably less than 2 or 3% of the cases. But when they have to be there, they have to be there, and they need a responsive system. Another thing that I would point out to you, and I'm sure you know from around the table with the legal experience and other experiences that you have, that lawyers engage in a lot of pro bono legal work. There was a survey about a year, 2 years ago, and that's kind of a difficult thing to track because it's going on in so many different degrees and through so many organizations, but there was an estimate that the generosity of the lawyers in the state of Minnesota contributes about 200,000 hours of pro bono legal work to the citizens and community of the state of Minnesota. So that process takes a lot of stress off of the system, takes a lot of stress from public defenders, takes a lot of stress stress from civil legal services, but it simply isn't enough. The dedicated people that work in public defense and civil legal services really need support for the work that they do. They represent the people that really, to a large extent, have nowhere else to turn. I will close and allow the other panelists here, Judge Maslow, to speak. But I had heard from Judge Perez, who is the chief judge of the tax court, last night, and he asked me if I would make a point, and it relates to the business component that I know their budget is a different budget than the one we're talking about today, but he asked me to remind you that the tax court, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the Office of Administrative Hearings also require adequate funding because they serve the citizens and they serve the businesses in the state of Minnesota. So thank you for your attention and for listening. The Bar Association would like to be a resource to you, and if you need information that we can provide, we are happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for those of you I haven't met, my name is Doug Meslow. I'm a judge in the 10th Judicial District, Anoka County. As some of you know, I've got some experience sitting in the chairs that you're in right now. 2003, I was a first-term, newly elected legislator facing a $6.2 billion deficit, and I thought, what have I gotten myself into? Now, I'll tell you, I think your job's harder than the job we had then. We had some tobacco money. We had some other things that were available to us. That's going to be a tougher decision for you, but let me talk about the process that we followed back then. We started by looking at, what are we here for? What does government exist for? And that began with the courts, because we looked at that and we realized that the courts were a separate and co-equal branch of government. They were a foundation of our very governmental system, and they were a core function of government. And we kept coming back to that as we made that analysis. Now, how does that really work? You've heard statistics this morning that I think are valuable, some theoretical examples. Let me give you a window into my world. I'm here this morning because Judge Fitzpatrick back in Anoka County has doubled up on calendars to take my 8:30 calendars. Now at 10:30, I've got a hearing to decide what evidence is going to come in a trial. That's the trial in which a 12-year-old boy is accused of raping his 10-year-old neighbor girl. I'll have that trial next month, but now I'm deciding what evidence comes in. Thursday, I have 22 cases on the calendar that are all child protection cases. I will be deciding when to take children out of a home, when to put them back in the home, when to close court files, and when to say these parents will lose their children forever and presumptively lose any children they would ever have again. 22 of those cases on Thursday. Next week, I'm beginning a jury trial in which somebody is charged with burning over 200 acres of parkland in Anoka County and is charged with arson. That trial is probably going to last us 2 to 3 weeks. These are the things that are happening in my world. These are the kinds of cases that are touched by everybody you've seen up here. Each of the different groups that have been represented in the speakers that have come up here today are involved in at least one of the types of cases that I've described for you right now. That's my world. And one of the things I want to do is invite you into that world. We're setting up a day in Anoka County in particular where we're going to bring legislators in and invite them for a judicial ride-along so that they can see what's happening. But I'll extend that invitation to you anytime. That could be in your home county, and you are always welcome to come and see what I'm doing. I don't care what day you want to pick. I trust you. It's an interesting process. But at the same time, you'll see how vital that work is and how necessary that work is. We depend on you. While we provide funding back to the state through fine collections, through court filing fees, we don't fund ourselves. It's been true for several years that under Republican leadership, under DFL leadership, this committee has been a staunch advocate for our court system and the people that operate in it. It has also been true that this is a committee that has worked in a bipartisan way very, very effectively. I will tell you, we desperately need you now. We're going to keep doing the work that we're doing. But if we have less money, we'll do it more slowly. Cases will take longer to get processed. They will take longer to get to be brought to trial. And the citizens of Minnesota cannot afford that. It's too important. We will continue to innovate. We will continue to streamline. We will continue to be aggressive. But that won't be enough without your help. Those of you who have been here have given us that help over the years, and I appreciate that. Those of you who are new will have lots of tough choices. But the court system needs your advocacy, needs your help. And I thank you all for your attention, for your time this morning. I would also be willing to field any questions, as I know the other people who have spoken today would do the same. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Hotel, as well. That is the end of our testimony. I noticed the bulk of the testifiers have remained in the courtroom. Are there any questions from any committee member? If not, Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for their testimony, but out of respect for the chair, I want to run this through you and ask if you would ask for an answer back on a couple of issues that we really haven't made any headway on, it seems like. And one of them, the first one, is the public defenders. Time and time again, we've tried to solve the problem of people getting public defense that don't deserve it, that have the wherewithal to pay for their own. And just a case in point is a sex offender in my area that's been in the paper a lot lately to do with the pardon and everything. He's out on bail. While he was in the bar bragging about how well his business was doing, he was expanding it, and he went in front of the judge and got bail and made bail, and he came up with $25,000 of his own money to bail out, but yet he couldn't pay for his public defender, and he's riding on public defense. And it seems like committee meeting after meeting, year after year, we address this situation, but it's still people in the public are in amazement to the people that are qualifying for public defense. And it can't answer it today, I know, but some type of answer on how we're going to get a hold on that. And then the judicial aspect, Mr. Chairman, bail is still way too low, and with conditions and without conditions. With conditions is basically a joke, as I'm sure a lot of the judges and prosecutors know, because these guys get let out. Domestic abuse cases, even with electronic monitoring, as good as the cops are in enforcing this, unless you've got a shock collar on the person that disables them, he's over to the house and assaults a person before electronic monitoring can ever discover where they're at. And they continually get out with too low bail, and the judges are all over the board from International Falls to Worthington on how much bail. And you know, just tired of this old argument, and it's a good argument about the Constitution, about excessive bail, and you have to have some bail, but some judges are saying no bail. Some of them are personal recognizance, some are 100,000, and these people are able to make bail. And so somehow to solve this question and protect the victims of abuse and everything else that are happening after these people get out, if there's any way to that when you come back, if you can have some answer on the lack of uniformity on the application of bail, and bail with conditions and without, and why it's all over the board. Those two questions would really help if they could get answered somehow or some type of a solution.
We're going to close this meeting shortly, but and you will all be back to further go into your particular budgets. But, Judge, you raised a hand. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I can give you at least a partial answer as to something that we're trying to do on the bail question. First, one thing that's a little bit different is that statewide there are very specific guidelines with regard to sentencing at the end of a case. There are not those same kinds of statewide guidelines that are set out for judges, and that's one of the reasons it tends to be all over the board. I'll tell you one of the ways we try to address it in Anoka County. We have 17 judges, but on that calendar where bail is set, we only have 4 judges sitting at a time. Those judges also meet at least once a month. And the idea is that we want to try to establish consistency within the county among those 4 judges. Rather than having a range of 17 judges who could all do very different things, we try to tighten that down to a smaller group, have that group in contact with each other, and try to maintain a high degree of consistency with that. That's one of our local solutions, because I agree with you. That's why we changed the system, is we thought we were having too much variety. And I don't think that's appropriate.
Okay, we have 2 reps that came in a little bit later, and also we didn't respect the pages. Representative Tilbury, we went around earlier and had a max of 2 minutes to just tell off on ourselves, district, so on and so forth, so shoot.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Happen to be from District 51B, which is Fridley, Spring Lake Park, Mounds View, and a little bit of Blaine. And a little bit about myself. I happen to work at Roseville Area High School as a high school counselor, and have been there for 15 years. Also have a wife, my high school sweetheart, and also 2 children. 22 would be my son Paul, who happens to be going to school at Southeast Tech down in Winona, where he's living, and then also my daughter at the University of Minnesota, 19 years old, who is expecting to graduate next semester. So that's an amazing feat, I think. But I had to mention that.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative John Lesch from St. Paul in my 5th term. I believe my reputation precedes me.
Pages, want to stand up and give us your name, where you're from? Very good, ladies and gentlemen who came today to testify. We'll see you again at your convenience, or at ours, or both. Thank you very much. Just a closing piece of business. We will be not meeting next week Thursday, except this Thursday, excuse me. We will be meeting next week Tuesday at our regular appointed time. But this Thursday, no meeting. GOP members, watch your email for a meeting at that time, potentially. Anything else? Any other business? If not, this meeting is adjourned.